Here in the dead of winter, it is a good time to talk about summer. And it is summer on the southern part of the planet, although summer is a relative term in Antarctica, where the high temperature for today at McMurdo Station is an almost not freezing 29 degrees Fahrenheit. Our next guest has traveled several times to Antarctica to work. Paul Seiko is an evolutionary biologist, now holding a courtesy research appointment at the University of Oregon. He joins us for this month's edition of Curious, Research Meets Radio, and we have many questions about his work setting up an underwater monitoring station, which involved diving in water only reached by breaking ice. Dr. Seiko, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Yeah, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And let me let people know if they want to look for you online. It's Seiko spelled C-Z-I-K-O, so paulseiko.net. Gets you there. And I thought I was making too much of the whole diving into the ice thing, but there's the picture at paulseiko.net of you strapping on your fins, hovering over this hole in what appears to be about 2 or 3 feet of ice over ice blue water beneath. What did you have to do that for the first time?
Well, yeah, the first time is definitely scary. But, you know, you say 2 to 3 feet of ice, and we typically see 6 feet to upwards of 20 feet of ice that we dive through.
Wow.
And so, yeah, we cut a hole, typically about 4 feet diameter hole, and we can either use big equipment, kind of like a telephone pole auger with a big bit on it, or we can use chainsaw or melt the hole. And then once we can get through into the ice, into the water, it's really an amazing environment under there.
You know, and it really, I have to talk about that later on, about the images of it, but just in terms of acclimation to it, what do you have to wear to get into that 28-degree water?
Well, I think a lot of the divers along in your listening area along the coast are probably familiar with what we wear. It's a dry suit with extremely thick undergarments underneath that, and then we have thick gloves and a hood that covers our head. So we're actually pretty much insulated from the water. We definitely get cold. But, you know, it's not as bad as it might look.
Mm-hmm. How do you really have to limit your time during such a dive?
No, our dives are typically limited by the amount of air that we have in our tank. So they're like typical recreational dives. They top out at about 45 minutes. And if you stay really shallow and you have more air, you might get an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And after a dive like that, you're definitely cold. You're chilled all the way through. And, you know, if you've been sitting still doing some fine work, like collecting fish eggs or something, your hands are definitely cold at the end of a dive.
How long to recover from such a dive?
Well, I do pretty well. I seem to warm up pretty quickly after a dive. So, you know, we can wait an hour and then do another dive. You know, it just depends on, you know, what you're in. If you're outside diving, you're going to be cold between dives. If you're in a hut or something like that, you can probably do more dives in a day.
Okay, well, we got the mechanics out of the way, but so go to the bigger picture. What drew you to Antarctica in the first place?
Yeah, well, I started as an undergraduate at the University of Illinois, and working with Art DeVries, who's kind of a legend in Antarctic marine research, and he discovered that the fishes down there only survive because they have these antifreeze proteins in their blood. Any normal fish from anywhere else in the world, assuming they could deal with the cold temperatures, they would still die down there. They would freeze almost instantly upon hitting the water. And so a lot of my research has been understanding the fishes and the evolution of their freezing avoidance mechanisms. Their goal is to not freeze. If they do freeze, they die.
So these antifreeze proteins, are they anything like what we use for non-freezing properties in our machinery, like anything like ethylene glycol in our antifreeze in the cars?
No, these are totally different. So ethylene glycol works like salt, and if you add salt, you add more stuff to water, it lowers the freezing point. But these actually bind to ice crystals. They're proteins that have specifically evolved to recognize the surface of ice crystals and stick to them. And so you can have ice around, but the ice won't grow. It's covered with this layer of these antifreeze proteins, and that allows you to lower the temperature lower than you would expect to be able to and still not freeze.
That's pretty wild. It almost sounds like antibodies for ice.
It is, in a way, yeah. It's a very specific interaction between these proteins and the ice surface.
Paul Seiko is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio, our joint project with the University of Oregon. He is an evolutionary biologist and a research assistant professor at the Institute of Ecology and Evolution at the U of O. If you've got questions about his Antarctica work and other bits of his research, join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 on the phone or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Now, you are the project leader for something with the delightful acronym of MOO, the McMurdo Oceanographic Observatory. Tell us about that and what that's all about.
Yeah, well, the idea is that, you know, we typically dive for an hour at a time or 45 minutes at a time, and we're only under the ice for a couple of months each year. And, you know, to be able to understand how these fishes survive and other things in this really extreme, harsh, cold environment, we needed to be able to see under the water all the time. And so back in 2017, we installed the McMurdo Oceanographic Observatory under the ice, the first of its kind anywhere in Antarctica. And it was a live streaming underwater pan, tilt, zoom camera. And then it also had seawater sensors so we could know the conditions that the fishes were experiencing in real time and all the time. And then also a hydrophone, so an underwater microphone, so we could listen to the soundscape under the ice. And the idea was to really support our studies of these Antarctic fishes and to understand the conditions that they experience and, you know, when do they have the challenge of not freezing, when is that most important, and how they get away from it. But that being said, we've found all sorts of other neat things just by having eyes and ears under the ice in Antarctica.
Well, the pictures and the research are fascinating, and I guess I expected the sea floor below the ice to look desert-like, like the snowy area above, but it's not from the pictures. I mean, in addition to the fish, what kinds of things do you have living down there?
Yeah, it's such a stark contrast. You know, most people that experience Antarctica see the surface, which is at McMurdo Station, which is at the southern end of the Ross Sea, about 2,500 miles south of New Zealand. You just see ice. It's white and black. That's all you see. And as soon as you get under the ice, it's really teeming with life. There's sponges, soft corals, sea stars, sea anemones, you know, pretty much everything you would see in a tropical reef. The colors are a little bit muted compared to that, and there's not quite as many fish around, but it is really just an amazingly vibrant and diverse underwater habitat there.
So it's creatures we're all familiar with, and you mentioned in a tropical environment too, sponges, corals, sea stars, all that sort of thing. How different are these creatures, though, from their warm water counterparts?
You know, a lot of them are not different. A lot of the Antarctic marine life is endemic to Antarctica, meaning it only occurs there. And oceanographically, Antarctica is separated from the rest of the world's oceans. So they've been kind of stuck in this cold freeze down there for at least 20 million years or so. And one of the main differences is that the fish diversity is really limited. Like I was saying, these fishes, the notothenioid fishes, they have evolved these antifreeze proteins that permits them to survive. So pretty much all the fishes that we see are relatively closely related, coming from a single ancestor that happened to solve this problem. And we see about 8 or 10 different species of fish regularly, which is way fewer than you would see on the coast here than in a tropical reef environment.
And what does the general name for that class of fish, the notothenioids, mean?
Well, notos is in Greek, the south wind, and phen is from. So it's from the south wind or from the south.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the Antarctic Ocean is separated from the other oceans oceanographically. How so?
Well, so Antarctica used to be much warmer and kind of stuck up in the subtropics and tropics with in Gondwanaland, the southern supercontinent. And then it started moving south. And by the time it got maybe about 60 million years ago, it got to its current position. And then several million years later, the Drake Passage opened up between the Antarctic Peninsula and the southern tip of South America. And then with winds and other oceanographic phenomena, a big, deep, cold current set up around Antarctica. So the surface waters, are kind of in this isolated place at the bottom of the ocean. And the warmer subtropical currents are deflected from that. And there's other things going on as well, but there's a very sharp gradient from the warmer subtropical waters to the colder Antarctic waters, and animals have a hard time traversing that.
Mm-hmm. Is there any parallel to the notothenioid fish in the warmer part of the world?
No, they're really pretty much an endemic Antarctic group of fishes. There's a few that have escaped from Antarctica and gone back to some sub-Antarctic islands and maybe New Zealand. But they pretty much only exist in the extreme southern hemisphere.
And I noticed, Paul, that you caught the fish live often by diving again. What's the advantage in taking the fish live rather than trying to hook them?
We can hook them from the surface. A lot of them are, when we get there, they've just gone through. We get there in usually late September, October. They've gone through 4 months of essentially no sunlight in the Antarctic winter. And so they're really hungry. So you can hook them from the surface, and a lot of them are relatively easy to catch. But you can pick and choose if you go for a dive, and you don't spend as much time standing out in the cold on the surface waiting for your fish to bite.
Sure. So it's actually better to be in the cold water than to be standing up above it.
Right. And, everyone wants to go for a dive. It's beautiful underwater.
It is pretty amazing, I have to admit. It's how many dives had you done in warmer water before you got into Antarctica? Or was there a process of acclimation by going further south or something?
No, I was a pretty new diver when I started in Antarctica. I had my requisite number of dives to dive down there. And in some ways, it's really easy diving. You don't have to crawl over a rocky shoreline or jump off a moving boat. You just drive up to the hole in your track vehicle and and jump in. And then we're not dealing with waves and current. Or we are doing some small currents, but we're not dealing with waves and swell and overhead boats that could hit you in the head, things like that. So, and the other thing is of course, like I said, when we get there, it's been dark for 4 months of the year. So the water is extremely clear. We have visibility of 300 to maybe 900 feet. Mm-hmm. So when you're underwater, it feels almost like you're in space.
Paul Seiko, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an instructor at the Institute of Marine Biology, research assistant professor in the Institute of Ecology and Evolution now at the University of Oregon, our guest in this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio, talking about his exploits in Antarctica, where he's traveled quite a few times and set up the McMurdo Oceanographic Observatory, or MOO. And if you have questions or comments or things you want to learn from our guest, join us while we're here at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Diving aside, I just wonder about the general level of orientation to a place that is so cold, so white, and yet also so sunny while you're there.
I guess I kind of feel like it's my backyard, McMurdo Sound. I've been going down there since 2002, and I've done 200 dives or so. So McMurdo Station is run by the United States Antarctic Program, which is funded by the National Science Foundation. It feels kind of like a small town. There's about 800 people there in the summer, typically an eclectic mix of people. You get used to it, and it's the frontier. It's a beautiful place to work. I feel at home whenever I show up there.
So is MOO still active? You talked about it's getting set up in 2017, but is it still doing its work? Is it still down there?
Yeah, it's not at the moment. So as most federally funded research projects go, it was a three-year project, and that included 2 years in the water, and everything survived great, and it was still running when we took it out. And then we've spent the last year working on working up some of the scientific results that we found, and we're kind of planning for making better stuff and putting it in the water again a few years down the road.
It looked like a fairly compact setup, the stuff that you ended up sticking in an array on the ocean floor. Did modern technology really help in establishing the observatory?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot to be said for how technology is helping us understand the underwater environment. And so, yeah, this was an Ethernet device. The whole thing was essentially on Ethernet, like anything else, any other computers or whatnot, but it was under the ice. So, amazingly, I could see under the ice from my office here at the University of Oregon from 9,000 miles away. So I click a button here and something moves under the ice in Antarctica, and that's really phenomenal. And I think that's showing where we're going to go for these small micro observatories and how they're really going to help us understand the marine environment.
So you could swivel the cameras, turn on the lights, the whole works.
That's right. Yeah, and you know, we're collecting lots of data. We're also listening to the sounds. So this underwater soundscape is really amazing as well. You know, most animals are excluded because of the thick ice, but there's the Weddell seals down there, and the Weddell seals live there year-round. They have big teeth on their upper jaw that they can help to scrape a hole in the ice or keep it open, and they have this really otherworldly these really otherworldly vocalizations, and I always say it sounds like a space battle in Star Wars with the pew-pews and buzzes and whistles and trills. And
I forgot to tell Maddie about this. I actually did get some sounds of Weddell seals, so we have Weddell seal sounds. Let's play those right now. So I want to point out that is not sped up, Paul Seiko. That's actually what they sound like. That's really the sound of the Weddell seals.
That's what it sounds like. When we're diving the whole time, you can actually, when you're standing on the ice near a seal colony, you can hear them through the ice, lying on the ice, and you hear it coming up through. And so those are the sounds that you can hear, a human can hear. And we've long known about those sounds. But one of our discoveries that we just published last month was that they also make sounds that you can't hear. So ultrasonic sounds above the range of human hearing, and you know, this is the first discovery of ultrasonic sounds in pinnipeds, which is the group of animals that includes seals, sea lions, and walrus.
That's some pretty amazing stuff. And so you knew about the audible sounds already, you're saying?
That's right. Yeah, they've been long known. They've been the Weddell seals are one of the most vocal species of seals. And they have about 50 call types that they regularly make. And then we added 9 call types that are above the range of human hearing. And, you know, we don't know what these calls do at this point. But we speculate that, you know, they could be for communication, maybe, switching to a higher frequency channel when the lower frequencies are cluttered by their own sounds or other sounds. Or also maybe for a form of echolocation. That is using sound or the echoes of your sounds to get an understanding of your environment. And this is what, you know, bats and dolphins do. But it's not really known if seals do this. And this the higher frequencies would allow them to resolve smaller objects underwater. And you gotta remember that these seals also spend that 4 months of each year in absolute darkness. Mm-hmm. Diving under the ice with only, you know, these few isolated access holes, and they do just fine.
Wow.
So they must be using sound in some way, and I hope that, you know, further research will elucidate what that is.
Randy and Roosh sent in an email asking about any elapsed seal encounters. I'm not sure what he means by elapsed, but does that make sense?
No.
Okay. So did you actually come face to face with the Weddell seals at some point? I mean, were they curious about you?
All the time, yeah. They're always around. They're pretty docile, a little curious. Every once in a while, they'll bite on your fin or something like that, a territorial male during the breeding season. But we've never really had any problems with the Weddell seals. And the more dangerous leopard seal is can't hold its breath as long as the Weddell seal, so they stay further away from us at the ice edge.
Oh, so is that you have to pick your spot carefully for where you're going to put your equipment?
No, we typically stay away from the ice edge, and you know, away from penguin colonies where the leopard seals would be.
Sure. So talk about the fact that you did get a chance to you could move the controls from the McMurdo Oceanographic Observatory from your office in Eugene, but you also get a chance to look at things during the dark months, the 4 months in the dark down there. Were some things that you got to see that people hadn't seen before?
Well, even just getting long-term images from under the ice is really, you know, phenomenal. There have been twice as many astronauts in space than there have been under the ice down there. So, you know, it's not a place that's well known. And so we've made some long-term time lapses. We're just doing that now. That gives, you know, shows where animals move and you know, it's amazing the things you see, learn about the fishes. There was one fish on a rock that I just saw the other day in a two-year time lapse. It spent 14 months on a rock. So these, you know, having eyes and ears like this shows you that these animals, this is their home. You know, it's not just this ephemeral thing. It's this ephemeral community that you see every once in a while and shows up and disappears.
You're sure the 14-month on a rock fish is alive?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, that's right. It would pop up and eat something out of the water column. Huh. And then the other thing, you know, we're trying to understand how underwater ice grows. And something special about McMurdo Sound, it's right at the edge of the Ross Ice Shelf, mm-hmm. which is this huge quarter-mile thick floating body of ice about the size of France. And we get this super cold water that flushes out from under there. And it actually grows ice in the water column and on the seafloor. We call that anchor ice. And when there's ice in the water column, it feels almost like an upside-down snowstorm, little crystals of ice crystallizing around you and then floating up to the underside of the ice. So we think that's a particular risk for the fishes and their freezing avoidance strategy. During those super-cooled conditions, it looks like the ice gets into the fishes. So these fishes actually have ice from the environment in their bodies. And so we recorded a couple of those events from this camera.
Wow. So, not much time left here, about 30 seconds. Did you notice much change from climate just in the 3 years that the observatory was active?
You know, that's the thing is, you know, we just don't have an understanding long term of what's going on under the ice down there. So we don't have a baseline, and that's the same in many places in the world. We need to get these baseline, you know, micro observatories and big observatories in underwater so that we can address those kinds of questions. At this point, we don't have enough data to see to know if things have changed down there. Right. They've certainly changed in other places around Antarctica.
Indeed. Paul Seiko, evolutionary biologist, research assistant professor, Institute of Ecology and Evolution at the University of Oregon. Thanks for joining us in Curious.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff.
All right, take care.